Good morning, Your Honors. C.J. Seitz with me is my partner, Garrett Moritz. And also with us this morning is William Savitt from Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen, and Katz. And with the court's permission, Mr. Savitt will make the argument this morning.
Welcome to the court.
May it please the court. Good morning, and thank you for hearing us. We are here on an appeal from an order of the Court of Chancery enjoining an $8 billion stock repurchase agreement in which Activision would buy its own shares from Vivendi, its controlling stockholder, and thereby return control of the company to its unaffiliated public stockholders. The injunction was entered the day before the agreement was to close, just 1 week after the action was filed, after 7 weeks of unexcused delay. It was entered after a temporary restraining order hearing, not an injunction hearing, on the basis of essentially no record in circumstances where the plaintiff had not even moved for a preliminary injunction and in circumstances where defendants had had no notice that there was to be an injunction hearing considered. The lower court's order has stopped this deal in its tracks. It's a deal that everyone concedes is in Activision's interests and in the interests of its public stockholders. It's a deal that has already created $1 billion of shareholder value. And it's a deal that creates for Activision stockholders the possibility of a future control premium, which they do not presently have as the company is controlled.
Mr. Savitt, perhaps I should ask this question of the other side, but when you talk about the best interest of the stockholders here, is the underlying fundamental concern that the plaintiffs now, appellees have, that insiders have an interest different than that of the other stockholders?
Thank you, Chief Justice Steele. And I should say, I think that is an important part of the plaintiff's case. It is, I would concur with the court, a question perhaps better answered by my friends on the other side. The complaint does raise allegations precisely along those lines. Those allegations, however, make no part of the injunction application and are, I think it is conceded, are not fit for an application for injunctive relief. If those claims are to be raised, well, then they can proceed.
I asked the question of you, and I will probably ask the question of the other side, because what I'm trying to determine in my own mind is why would a vote of the majority of the minority not approve the deal when everything I read and hear in the briefs suggest, and in the transcript below, suggests that there's almost universal belief that this is a good deal for the stockholders. There must be some reason beyond the discounted price for the shares.
Well, we think there is virtually no chance that if there were to be a stockholder vote, if it could be held in time, that the stockholders would approve it. There is certainly no reason to think that it would not. The transaction in our contemplation does not require a stockholder vote, and it was not negotiated to include one because the organic documents of Activision did not so provide. But as Your Honor indicates, this transaction has received widespread approbation from every corner of the marketplace. Indeed, it is no part of the plaintiff's complaint that there is something wrong with the underlying transaction. Accordingly, while there's no record on the point, there's no reason to think that this would not be widely approved by any fraction of the Activision stockholder body to whom it was submitted.
Let me ask you a question about the reality on the ground. As I understand it, there is financing in place until mid-December, is that correct?
Yes, Justice Jacobs, until December 18th.
Right. And were we to agree that there should be a shareholders meeting, I understand that draft proxy materials have been prepared.
Yes, Your Honor. The company seeking to keep alive the possibility of complying with an order requiring a vote, should it be ordered by this court, has undertaken to file a preliminary proxy statement. That is with the SEC.
And does the SEC commonly review these proxy statements?
The answer to that is yes. I don't know whether it will review this proxy statement. And it's a somewhat odd proxy statement, as we tried to set out in our papers. It's one that makes clear that the transaction is entirely hypothetical at this point. I say that because come October 15th, which is next Tuesday, the counterparties to Activision have every right to walk away from this transaction. They have given no assurance that they will not. True, They've said they're committed to the deal. They had no choice but to say that, given the pendency of the transaction.
Well, I realize the question may be hypothetical, but is it in light of those realities, and assuming that the counterparty doesn't walk, is it physically possible to have a shareholders meeting completed before mid-December?
We think it is highly questionable. We will certainly do our best if there is no choice, but there is absolutely no assurance. We are in October. There isn't a lot of time between now and then. The government is shut down. This is the sort of proxy statement that we think reasonably likely to attract review. The best I can say, Your Honor, is if the company is in a position where it has a deal like that to pursue, if it survives the drop-dead date, we'll do everything we can, but we have no assurance that that will happen, nor any assurance that the SEC will be cooperative, and there is very substantial reason to fear
that we will not
be able to get there in time.
So you'll give us a definitive maybe?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. It's the best I can do because it's in the hands of the SEC. Now, the injunction rested on the court's conclusion as to the merits that Activision's purchase of its own shares was a merger or a business combination or something similar to a merger or a business combination. There are no businesses combining here. There's no merger of Activision and Vivendi. That's not happening. There's nothing remotely like a combination transaction here. To the contrary, the transaction marks the separation of Activision and Vivendi. It marks Vivendi's exit from Activision as its controlling stockholder.
But the vehicle for doing that is not the actual direct purchase of its own shares, is that right?
That's correct, Justice Ridgely. It is the form of the transaction is that Activision is purchasing the shares of a holding company that holds stock and some net operating loss carry forwards.
But what is ultimately contemplated to be the fate of the holding company?
The fate of the holding company is that it will stay in exactly the form that it is, that is contractually provided, in fact. And it will not change. There is no contemplated combination of any kind between that entity and Activision. It is not even so alleged, has never been so claimed.
Would it buy other assets to be held?
It would not. Indeed, it is contractually prohibited at present from conducting any other business than existing in its present form, holding the assets that it holds.
And what happens when the NOLs are exhausted?
My understanding is that the NOLs either will or will not become applicable and therefore either will or will not effectively reduce the purchase price to Activision's public stockholders. When they expire by their own terms and they have no force and effect thereafter.
One of the issues that's suggested by the briefs is the interaction between your side's latches defense and the argument that the Court of Chancery erred by converting the TRO application to a preliminary injunction application without notice. My question is this. Assume that we agree with you that the Court of Chancery erred by not giving notice that it was intending to treat this matter as a preliminary injunction application. Assume also that we disagree that the plaintiff was guilty, so to speak, of latches in its timing in filing the complaint. What happens in those circumstances?
Your Honor, in those circumstances, we'd be left with a position where we are not even two full business days from the drop-dead date of this transaction. The order below would have been improvidently granted, if I understand the court's.
Well, let me ask the question a different way. If you're correct on your procedural argument, then the matter should be remanded so that evidence can be taken in connection with a preliminary injunction hearing. That assumes that latches is out of the picture. So if that's the scenario, what happens?
I think what happens in that case is the matter would be remanded, assuming this court says nothing respecting the merits, and we have fully addressed the merits, as the court well knows. And the plaintiffs would be in a position where they would have no adequate time to make their case, to carry their burden with respect to the extraordinary relief that they seek.
If this had been a straight repurchase and a holding company was not used, do you think we would be here today?
Justice Holland, thank you for that question, which I think is a good one. The answer seems to be clearly no. There is nothing in the form of argument from my friends on the other side that suggests that it could be remotely applicable to a straight purchase of stock. And it's one of the oddities of their position, because it's not a straight purchase of stock because it's housed together with net operating loss carryforwards, which reduce the price to Activision stockholders.
Well, and that's, and that's my next question. Has anybody quantified the monetary advantage of using the holding company?
We have looked into this question, Your Honor. The answer is I can't answer it because the valuation of net operating loss carryforwards is an inexact science that, frankly, you can't get an answer on. They have some contingent value, which may or may not come to fruition. But the only effect they can have is to make this deal a better deal for Activision stockholders, other than Vivendi, for the public stockholders.
Well, I understand. I mean, I ask the question in the context of what we see in the briefs about the argument of form and structure, and that this is a repurchase that's been advantageously put together. And I just wondered, you know, since you wound up in court, somebody decided it was worth it to structure it this way rather than as a simple repurchase.
Your Honor, that's exactly what has happened here. There isn't any doubt that it's a slightly more complicated transaction because of this benefit. It's a benefit that is worth having if you care about Activision's public stockholders, as my client, the special committee, does. The alternative to have a straight stock purchase, as Your Honor suggests, might have been easier. It would not have been, as a practical matter, any different. It just would have been less advantageous from the perspective of those folks who were looking out to try to protect the public stockholders of Activision.
Well, to follow up on Justice Holland's question, let's assume that the transaction took a slightly different form. First, the stock was repurchased directly, like an asset purchase, by Activision from Vivendi. And then the NOLs were transferred separately. I don't know whether it's tax law that drives the need to drop those NOLs into a subsidiary or not, but whatever. Would there be any economic difference between that transaction and the one that has actually been structured and is at issue here?
I believe that there would have been, because I think the NOLs have to be transferred in a package along with the stock for the benefits here to accrue. I think that is the only way to get that benefit. That's my understanding of the tax laws, Your Honor.
Well, because this oral argument appears to me to be shorter than I'd like it to be, can you tell us directly why you believe the Vice Chancellor erred when he found that this was a transaction similar to a business combination or merger?
Of course, Your Honor, and thank you. The relevant provision is Section 9.1B of the Activision Charter. It applies by its terms only to mergers and business combinations and similar transactions. Now, as a matter of plain language, we ask the question, is a transaction in which stock in Activision and some tax attributes are being purchased by Activision, is that like a merger or a business combination or something similar? And we would suggest the answer is no. It is a transaction in which Activision is buying control of itself. It is not merging with anything. It is not combining with anything. No two businesses are coming together. In fact, businesses are coming apart. Vivendi is going its own way. This is a separation. It may be that it is a transaction, but it's not a combination. It's not a combination in any natural use of language, and it will return control of the company to the public. Here again, that is not combining, it is separating. Now, we've also made the point, beyond what we think of the plain words of Section 9.1 applied to this transaction and its commercial reality, that the obligation confronted with a question of contract interpretation, hence of charter interpretation, is to look at the document as a whole. We have another provision in Activision's organic documents, in its bylaws, Section 3.12, that pertains to all related party transactions. So part of the job of contract interpretation is to make sense of how these provisions work together, 3.12 and 9.1b. 3.12 is very general. It applies to any related party transaction, and it requires in all those instances the approval of the independent directors of Activision before such a related party transaction go through. That is to say, my client's special committee. On top of that, there is Section 9.1B, and there are interpretive clues that indicate how 9.1B should operate in the hierarchy with Section 3.12. It applies only to mergers, business combinations, and similar transactions, not broadly to related party transactions. And it applies only in circumstances where Vivendi is a holder of, at a minimum, 35% and a maximum 90% of the shares of Activision, which tell us that the provision is concerned with those circumstances where Vivendi is in a position to use its clout as a controlling stockholder to undertake a transaction that will augment that control in the nature of a squeeze-out and like transaction.
Now, well, let me stop you there. Why is it only to protect in a situation where Vivendi wanted to augment its control? Why shouldn't it be read as applying to a situation where Vivendi wanted to force a transaction through its control? That this may not be your typical business combination, although there was an acquisition of a subsidiary. On the other hand, this is a transaction that serves Vivendi's purposes, and Vivendi had control to make sure this transaction took place.
Well, Your Honor, Justice Berger, I should say thank you for the question. It's a fair one. It is the question really has to be what do you take away from the 90-35 clue and from the business combination clue? Because it can't be that it doesn't mean anything. And that is my friend's interpretation. They just don't exist. It can't be. And what we would submit is that while the language is broad enough to cover circumstances where there is a combination of businesses that operates in a manner that would threaten the interests of Activision's public stockholders for whom the provision was plainly designed, it is implicated. But it is not implicated in a circumstance where there is not a combination by virtue of the very words of the provision, because that would render those words without meaning, and it would give no structure to the hierarchy of 312 and 9.1B.
But technically there is a combination here, isn't there? Activision is acquiring, is it Amber, an existing subsidiary. It may not be doing anything, but it's an entity that's being acquired by Activision.
To be sure, Activision is acquiring all the shares of Amber, which is a subsidiary of Vivendi. It is acquiring the shares of stock. However, it is not merging. It is not a business combination. There is nothing like that. There are no businesses coming together here in any way. What's happening is a shell company is being purchased, and in it is stock. It is not a business combination in any natural sense of the term. And there is no law for the proposition that any time a business, the shares of stock in a business are acquired, it amounts to a merger or a business combination or something similar. None at all. And there would have been a way to write that provision. But that's not what the drafters here chose. And it's
You seem to acknowledge that there is a difference between a direct purchase of the stock and the transaction that's been set up here where there's a purchase of a subsidiary, right? There is a difference between those two transactions.
Well, there's a difference in legal form insofar as they affect the ability of Activision's public stockholders to get the benefit of the NOLs. Yes.
Exactly. So there's a difference as to the form of the transaction. And doesn't the doctrine of independent legal significance pop up here in terms of if you can do something one way or another way, the way you chose to do the transaction is what governs?
Well, it's a fair question. I was giving some thought to the doctrine of independent legal significance and how it relates. The reason I don't think it's implicated here, Your Honor, is it is not our position that because this transaction could have been achieved some other way, it falls without the ambit of 9.1. To the contrary, our position is that when you look at the plain words of 9.1, you have to find some businesses combining. There aren't any. And when you look at the structure of this, which gives important clues as to the purpose of it and how it fits with background Delaware law, it's not implicated. And when you look, moreover, at commercial common sense, by which I mean the market, which has over and over and over again universally said this is a split, this is a separation, these are two companies coming together, it makes no sense to call this a business combination, not within the contemplation of the charter, not within the contemplation of the charter and the bylaws conceived together as they must be, and not as a matter of the sound construction of commercial contracts as it exists under our law.
Even focusing on the word combination, and how important is it to your argument that Amber's not going to be in business? So when we're talking about business combination, assuming there's a combination, it's not a combination with a business.
Very important, Your Honor. It in a sense, is another half of our argument. It's not a business and it's not a combination. It is stock that is sitting in a shell company. That doesn't make it a business. So it is very much part of our argument. You have neither a business nor a combination, certainly not a business combination.
Now, the words common sense have been raised quite often in this case, and the Vice Chancellor said, as a common sense matter, what is this charter provision designed to do? I think it's designed to give disinterested stockholders a vote on business combinations and things similar to business combinations involving the controller so that they can decide for themselves whether it's a good deal or not. What's wrong with that?
We think the court below erred because it attached to this provision the general idea that it ought be implicated whenever a significant transaction was implicated. That, I think, in words and substance, is what the Vice Chancellor said. That's not this provision. There is a protection built into the organic documents of the company in 3.12 that provides, under the circumstances where it's implicated, for independent director approval. There was independent director approval of this. The question then becomes, is it right? Is it right that any time value is moving, to use the court below's phrase, this provision is implicated? There is not a hint in the words of the charter that that is so. It also doesn't make much sense. Enormous sums of value could move, quite apart from anything that remotely implicated this provision. Indeed, we've been talking about the fact that you could have done a stock buyback of billions of shares without any argument that this applied. But what you can't do, according to the ruling of the court below, is add in some net operating loss carryforwards, which are a mere tax attribute, which is clearly beneficial to the class that's to be protected, to make the deal better. So we would submit that all of that means that it doesn't make a lot of common sense, and it is taking the words of 9.1 beyond their plain meaning as they appear in the contract.
You have 2.5 minutes for rebuttal. Did you want to save it?
Let me save that, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Good morning. May it please the court. And I'm going to start by trying to address some of the points that the court raised during my friend's argument. And Mr. Chief Justice, you raised, well, best interests of the stockholders. And the market says it's a good deal, they say. But the market doesn't get to decide. As the passage that Justice Ridgely read, this certificate provides for the stockholders to decide whether it's in their best interest. And this is a complicated transaction. All Mr. Sabat wanted to talk about was the aspect of it that involves Amber. But there's more to this transaction than that. There's also a so-called private sale of what will be a 25% interest in the company to management. Now, we don't know very much about that because
there is that difference. I agree with you. So what?
Well, Your Honor, because in terms of the best interest of the stockholders, they have to look at not just, purchase of the Vivendi subsidiary good or bad. They've got to look at overall, is this transaction, which may put management in a controlling position, is that in our best interest as well? And they've been given virtually no disclosure on that subject whatsoever.
So what?
Well, because, Your Honor, the in deciding whether it's in your best interest, you're going to want to know why was this private sale
done. This isn't a disclosure action.
Your Honor, but it's why a vote is important.
Well,
because the stockholders need to decide whether it's in their best interest.
What's the role of the special committee, who I understand from at least the pleadings is conceded to be disinterested and independent? What is their role?
Well, Your Honor, their role is that they can approve the transaction. It gets into the interrelationship of bylaw 3.123 and section 9.1B, and Mr. Savage refers to...
I didn't ask my question very well. What is the role of the special committee in analyzing the significance of what you might characterize as the management or insider special deal?
Well, Your Honor, their role in terms of they were created as a special committee. In terms of the governance of this corporation, there was a bylaw 3.12 that expired in July before this transaction was announced that required an independent director approval. However, section 9.1B specifically says that it's in addition to any approval that's required by the bylaws. And the hierarchy here...
Let's just stay with the agreement for a moment. And what's your position if this had been a straight stock repurchase?
Only a stock repurchase or a stock repurchase with the other elements of this combination, which include an amended investor agreement.
Let's just take it one step at a time. Let's suppose it's simply a stock repurchase.
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Savitt says that there's no law that would suggest that could be a business combination. We disagree. I spent some time on a drafting committee for a statute called Section 203, and one of the things that was involved in that was what kind of business combinations do you need to protect against, and this transaction would fall within that. Now, that the Vice Chancellor didn't incorporate Section 203's definition, but he said it was an example of what might be included as a business combination. You have here a huge transaction. $5.83 billion is flowing out of Activision to the controlling stockholder. That's the type of thing that when in 203, when you looked at what kind of transactions do we want to prevent in order to control the possibility that a controlling stockholder is going to do something damaging. Well, it said, well, if you're going to transfer more than 10% of your assets, and this is way more than 10% of the assets, it's way more than 10% of the market value to a controlling stockholder, that can be a business combination.
You're making a normative argument, aren't you? I mean, that it would be the good and the right thing if the shareholders could decide whether or not this $5.8 billion should pass out of the corporation up to Activision. But that's not the analysis that's called for under this agreement, is it?
Well, Your Honor, the analysis that's called for is under Section 9.1B.
Right.
And that says that any merger, business combination, or similar transaction involving Activision or an Activision subsidiary and Vivendi or a controlled affiliate of Vivendi. And significantly, it doesn't say certain types of controlled affiliates. Controlled affiliates that hold operating businesses. It's any controlled affiliate.
Yeah, and significantly, it also doesn't say any transaction between. It says similar to or a merger or business combination. So isn't the focus of the analysis on whether this is a business combination or similar transaction?
Yes, Your Honor.
Don't we read all three of those together to get a sense of what the drafters intended?
Well, Your Honor, in this instance, you know, there is a question of what did the drafters intend, what were the reasonable expectations of the stockholders. There was a proxy statement. It didn't mention any limitations on Section 9.1B. The drafters could have provided a definition of business combination. They talk about what sophisticated parties and what great lawyers they had who are such corporate law experts. Well, a corporate law expert would know that what a business combination is can depend on circumstances.
You've got 203, you've got accounting literature, you've got SEC regulations. So they were drafting this provision. They did not provide a definition, though they defined 15 other terms, and they defined other terms, and they used very broad language.
Well, help me out with this. I don't want this question to sound facetious. It's clearly not meant to be. But tell me what businesses are combined together and joined in such a way to jointly run a business under these circumstances.
Okay, under this transaction, under the stock purchase agreement, what happens? Okay, we've talked a lot about the transfer of the Vivendi subsidiary. That holds the Activision shares, which Vivendi identifies as its Activision business segment, and that's being transferred to Activision. We have the NOLs that actually, a lot of them relate to Vivendi Games, which was put into Activision in the 2008 transaction, and that's not being separated. So when they talk about, oh, this is a separation.
What business is being conducted?
By Amber?
Yeah.
There are five specific transactions that Amber engages in under Section 2.1 of the stock purchase agreement.
Which result in them operating what kind of business?
Your Honor, again, the provision does not require that the controlled affiliate be an operating business, but they are acquiring stock, they are issuing notes, they are assuming indebtedness. These are business activities, and they involve billions of dollars. And so to say it's not a business, well, many businesses are conducted through a holding company.
What about the language that your opponents focus on at the end of 9.1D with this 35 to 90% range?
Well, it's interesting that wasn't their focus below. And I think if the court looks at their briefs carefully and looks at what they said below, you'll find that they've had no fewer than three unambiguous interpretations of Section 9.1B. They now say, it's obviously limited to squeeze-outs because it uses the numbers 35% and 90%. But when the certificate wanted to refer to squeeze-outs, and they refer to Section 8.5, it specifically said so. It said merger or other business combination in which the minority stockholders will have their shares bought out at the buyout price. So when they wanted to limit it to squeeze-outs, or extraordinary transactions, as they now say. But the lead-in provision of Section 9.5, all that does is say, if the stockholdings are in a certain range, this voting right applies. It doesn't say anything about limiting what transactions are covered by the phrase any merger, business combination, or similar transaction involving, again, a very broad word, as opposed to requiring between. They could have said that, but are there mergers involved? Is Activision involved in a merger here? There are two mergers that occur under the restructuring transactions that are under a contract to which Activision is a party. The purchase of the Vivendi subsidiary, in this instance, it's done as a stock purchase. In 2008, it was done as a merger. The net result is going to be the same. This Vivendi subsidiary is going to become a wholly owned subsidiary of Activision. Its assets are combined with Activision's assets. The assets that were combined in 2008 remain there. They amend the investor agreement that was in 2008 to add ASAC. And what really has happened here is you have now a three-party business combination where ASAC has joined in. Management had some role in the 2008 combination, but now it's an expanded role. Vivendi is still there. They haven't separated. They're still a substantial stockholder with an investor agreement.
Mr. Hanrahan,
yes.
I'd like to bring you back to Justice Holland's question, which is if the repurchase of stock had been a straight repurchase without the intervention of a subsidiary, Amber in this case, Would that constitute a corporate business combination or similar transaction under 9.1B of the charter?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why?
Because you'd be transferring a large amount of assets, which represents Vivendi's Activision business segment, into Activision. The Activision stock is an asset, and you're transferring out $5.83 billion
is there any support
of
for that?
Activision's
the head. Stock is equity in the corporation. It could be used as currency, but is there any authority for the proposition that it's an asset?
Your Honor, is it carried
on the books as an asset?
No, Your Honor, but it is something that belongs to the corporation that is extremely, extremely valuable. In many ways, it's the most valuable thing that the corporation has, because it represents an interest in its business.
All right, so you're saying that in order to for us to affirm, we would have to agree with your position that even a direct buyback of this large block of stock would be a business combination?
No, Your Honor, because they didn't do it as a buyback, and the transaction is so much more.
I'm asking you, again, the hypothetical question, if it were done as a buyback, that would be a business combination. We would have to hold that.
I think, actually, in this instance, the Vice Chancellor didn't make that ruling on a reasonable probability of success. So it's a sort of double hypothetical in terms of the procedural posture of this case.
Well, that you talked about my question, now answer it.
Your Honor, the answer is I think the court should hold that.
Okay.
I think Section 203 C3 is authority that can be a business combination, and you have the ambiguity that's created by the drafters, Activision and Vivendi. You have the reasonable expectations of the stockholders with respect to a transaction that has a lot of similar elements to the 2008 business combination, which was described to the stockholders in a proxy statement and identified as a business combination. And so when there was no definition, when there was no limitation in the language, when all these broad terms were used, and you didn't say anything in the proxy statement to explain it, I think that the term has to be interpreted in these circumstances with this agreement as encompassing the stock purchase agreement, including all of its elements, not just the defendant's recharacterization of one element. You know, it's a stock purchase agreement, but when you look at the agreement, it defines the purchase as the purchase of the stock of the Vivendi subsidiary. And as to the NOLs, it's in the record, the chief financial officer of Activision, said they expect those to be worth $200 million. Indeed, Vivendi provides an indemnification for $200 million. So that the idea that these are somehow insignificant and that they don't constitute an asset that Vivendi is combining into Activision is just incorrect. $200 million is a lot of money.
Can we turn for a minute to the balancing of the equities before the issuance of the preliminary injunction?
Certainly.
Can you identify for us the elements that the Vice Chancellor analyzed in his balance of the equities, and answer one more specific question for me that's encompassed by that question? To what extent, on these facts, in this context, does the likelihood of a stockholder vote against this deal, under your theory that there is a right of the majority of the minority to vote, is that part of an analysis of the weighing of the relative harm?
I don't think that the court can speculate as to what stockholders will do with full information. That's why you require the holding of a vote and the issuance of a proxy statement.
Well, isn't that also why you require, before you issue a preliminary injunction, an opportunity for both sides to be heard by affidavit or otherwise about the likelihood of the relative harm to the parties?
And the defendants were heard, Your Honor. In fact, they submitted a 20-page expert report with 10 pages of exhibits as factual support in arguing the balance of harms, including the harm to the stockholders, the possible loss of financing, and Vivendi possibly walking away.
In a context of coming into a vice chancellor's office to discuss a TRO, which apparently it's at least argued suddenly becomes a preliminary injunction, is that fair notice and an opportunity to be heard on the issue of balancing of the ultimate harms?
Yes, Your Honor, and it wasn't just walking into the vice chancellor's office. They had more than a week's notice. They submitted 13 pages of letter memoranda on September 13th as to why no injunction hearing should be scheduled. They submitted a 35-page brief, a 20-page expert report with 10 pages of exhibits, an affidavit attaching four different documents.
Were they on notice that they would be asked to address more than whether or not the TRO presented a colorable claim, to have basically a standstill or a status quo until further developments with a further opportunity to be heard?
Well, Your Honor, they argued, you know, they argued the motion, which, again, a TRO with notice, the elements become very, very similar. And one thing we don't understand.
Very, very similar to what?
To the standards for a preliminary injunction. And
that's become the practice recently?
Well, Your Honor, it is not exactly the same, but it's very similar. But the bottom line is there was a question of, well, I think Justice Jacobs asked, well, what would happen? Well, what would have happened is that the court would have entered a TRO, because if we had met the preliminary injunction standards, then we certainly had met the TRO standards. And they would have been enjoined either way. Now, did they make any objection to the vice chancellor?
Is it still true that the customary length of a TRO is 10 days or less?
No, that's if it's without notice, Your Honor. And I think, you know, they conceded
so
that they had
notice. So this restraining order could go on for what period of time in your experience?
Well, the vice chancellor indicated at the September 13th conference that, you know, if he grants something, that it might be of short duration. But the defendants, they didn't say, oh, we object to you entering a preliminary injunction. They could have done that at numerous stages. They did not. And they could have pressed for a final hearing before October 15th.
What were the circumstances under which, now, I've read the transcript and it's not entirely clear to me. I'll preface my question with that comment. At what point did they realize that he was converting this TRO hearing into a preliminary injunction hearing, and saying that that was a higher standard for the plaintiff to meet, as if that's some consolation prize?
Well, Your Honor, he did that as a, he said, well, the defendants raised this latches issue. And so what I'm going to do is, rather than test this as to whether the plaintiff can meet the TRO standard, I'm going to test this by the preliminary injunction standard, so that even if we had met the TRO standard, if we didn't meet the preliminary injunction standard, he would not have granted the relief.
So the notice was given at the time of the oral argument.
No, the notice under Rule 65 is notice of the hearing and an opportunity to be heard. And they did have a, you know,
we're talking about the notice to the other side that the court was intending to treat this matter not as a TRO, but as a preliminary injunction. That occurred for the first time when the court was making its oral ruling. Is that correct?
I think actually the court may have indicated that during questioning, but I think it's fair, Your Honor.
It was on the same day.
Yeah. So the idea that there was some terrible wrong done to the defendants, they had every opportunity. They were in possession of all the extrinsic evidence.
They had every opportunity for what?
To present whatever they wanted, Your Honor. This was not a TRO that was limited to the allegations of the complaint. They put a 265-page proxy statement into the record.
If they had every opportunity, when they're on notice that the vice chancellor is going to decide something more than whether a TRO should issue, under what circumstances do they have an opportunity after he announces in his ruling that he's converting it to a preliminary injunction?
They could have. He asked them three times.
Should they have anticipated he was going to do that?
Your Honor, it has been, as we cited authority, it's been done in the past. It's been suggested that in a situation where there's a laches claim, that the plaintiff might be held to a higher standard. Vice Chancellor,
is being held to a higher standard the same thing as finding out at the time the court enters its order that while you thought you had been brought to a knife fight, it's actually a gunfight at the end of the day?
Well, Your Honor, I think that's not a fair characterization given the similar standards. And the other, and we go back to, okay, the Vice Chancellor asked them three times, any questions? They didn't raise any problem with it. In fact, they negotiated the form of preliminary injunction with us. Did they say, wait a minute, the court should hold a preliminary injunction hearing? No. They didn't raise this issue until they got up here on appeal. They didn't raise it in their interlocutory appeal application. They never raised it below. And then they come in here and say, oh, we think we should have gotten some different notice.
In some respect, we have to think of future cases besides this one. Is every practitioner in Chancery now on notice that when there's a TRO hearing, come prepared for a preliminary injunction hearing?
Well, I think you're already, you know, in a situation where they were claiming that the transaction was going to close the next day, which is something they decided after our complaint was filed. They announced that. That in the circumstances, and the thing was fully briefed, this is not a situation where we ran up to the court and said, enter a TRO. What they still have not explained is they would have been enjoined either way.
Yes, but there would be one major difference, and that is if the TRO had been granted as a TRO, you would then be back in the Court of Chancery taking discovery and moving toward a hearing on a motion for preliminary injunction, which would take place a week, a matter of time after. And in those circumstances, would that not change the balance of equities? You're in a different mode at that point.
Well, that's not what the defendants did, Your Honor. What they wanted to do instead is exactly what they did do, and that is come to this court and say the vice chancellor got it wrong on the interpretation of section 9.1B. But then somewhere along the lines, and it was after they filed their notice of appeal, because they never mentioned the notice point on the preliminary injunction in their interlocutory appeal application. They never said anything about it to the vice chancellor, and if they thought he did something wrong, they could have given him an opportunity to schedule a preliminary injunction, but that's not what they wanted. They wanted to get to this court, and they did. And so I think this appeal should be decided on the merits of the issues that are before the court, not some procedural thing that they thought up on appeal.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. A few quick points. One is to pick up on the colloquy that the court was just having with my friend, Mr. Hanrahan. Defendants had zero notice that a preliminary injunction was within contemplation. It was announced after counsel had ceased their arguments. It was announced as the ruling was being delivered. It was announced as the vice chancellor declared that he has made his mind up about the relevant questions and he was entering a preliminary injunction. There was no opportunity to contest it. All we had was the opportunity to seek to decide what to go forward with. And I should say, the vice chancellor said, if you don't like my ruling, go to the Supreme Court. That was his express instruction, as the transcript, I think, makes crystal clear. And TROs and preliminary injunctions are quite different animals. At least that's the way we see it. We think that's the way our clients see it. We think that's the way most responsible litigants see it. There was much talk of how the 2008 transaction is like the 2013 transaction. This is just flat wrong. I mean, in 2008, there was a company called Activision and a company called Blizzard. They were merged. They became Activision Blizzard, logically enough. It was a merger. And as part of that, the capital structures of companies were merged.
You're saying there were two operating businesses that were merged?
There were two operating businesses in 2008, Activision and Blizzard. They came together, Activision and Blizzard. The capital structures were put together. This time, Activision Blizzard isn't changing a whit. It's still Activision Blizzard. Nothing is combining. All that's happening is at the capital structure level, Vivendi is separating. That's all that's happening. The transactions are opposites. To say they're the same, it's like saying a green light and a red light are the same because they're both lights. But one is stop and one is go. They are different. They are fundamentally different in purpose and legal effect.
Your point is only the composition of the shareholders is changing.
That is right, Justice Holland. All that's happening is the same business now does not have a controlling stockholder. That's the only effect of this transaction.
And a transfer of a few billion dollars.
Yeah. To be sure.
Which includes borrowing a significant amount of money.
To be sure, Justice Berger, there is debt involved in this. However, the debt is creating for Activision stockholders a public company that has created massive increase on the equity side and provides the opportunity for a future control premium.
But again, you seem to be focusing on how good this deal is and how beneficial it is for Activision, but is that really of consequence in terms of analyzing what the provision requires?
It is in consequence insofar as even the debt transaction partakes in no way of a business combination, a merger, or anything like it. I believe I'm out of time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, counsel. My compliments on the briefs and our compliments on the oral argument. I would request that after we recess that you keep in contact with the clerk of the court so you know how we stand on the issue for the rest of the day. Court's in recess.
Please rise.